Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. 2.3 million people are incarcerated in the United States. This country has the highest number of people in prison in the world. As a result, one in four women and nearly one in two black women has at one point had a family member in prison. In her new aerial dance performance, The Weight Room, today's guest, choreographer and dancer Joe Kreider, blends oral history, dance, music, and public art to explore the physical, psychic, and emotional burdens incarceration places on women with loved ones who are behind bars. The Weight Room is the most personal work Joe Kreider has undertaken since she founded Flyaway Productions back in 1996. When she announced The Weight Room, she said, quote, "I have a partner who was incarcerated, and I have lived the last 8 years wedged between the fracture of incarceration and the hopefulness of dance making," end quote. Joe Kreider and her amazing team partnered with Oakland-based Essie Justice Group. That's an organization with a mission to harness the collective power of women with incarcerated loved ones to end mass incarceration's harm to women and communities. Every performer in The Weight Room has or has had a loved one incarcerated. If you are in the Bay Area, I hope you can see this performance. The Weight Room runs April 19th to the 27th at 1125 Market Street in San Francisco, a vacant lot opposite UN Plaza at the Civic Center. The Weight Room will then travel to Richmond, California for two performances on May 17th and 18th in partnership with the East Bay Center for the Performing Arts. And then it is off to New York. All of the performances are free with no reservation required, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Joining us to talk about The Weight Room and mass incarceration's impacts on families are three guests. Joe Kreider is a San Francisco-based choreographer with a background in political science. She is the founder and artistic director of Flyaway Productions. That's an apparatus-based dance company that explores the range and power of female physicality and advances social issues in the public realm. And Joe joins us in studio. I should also mention that Joe is a fellow of the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation. Hi, Joe. Thank you for coming in. Congratulations on the fellowship.
Thank you, Rose. It's great to be back.
Well, it's great to have you back. We're also joined by Anita Wills, author of seven books, including A Nation of Flaws, which is a historical account of policing in the United States. Anita is also a lecturer, activist, advocate, and radio show host. Anita also works with the Essie Justice Group. Her son was incarcerated in 2011, and Anita believes he was wrongfully charged. Hi, Anita. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Jasmine Brown, events coordinator and education facilitator for the Black Female Project and the Essie Justice Group. Since completing her BA in African American Studies with an emphasis in film from UCLA, Jasmine has worked as an arts administrator and curator at various museums, including the Museum of the African Diaspora in San Francisco. Jasmine's father has been incarcerated most, if not all, of her life. She saw him for the first time in 15 years last November, and Jasmine credits the decision to see him to the work she has done with the Essie Justice Group. That's pretty heavy. Hi, Jasmine. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Joe, I want to start off with you. You have been on the show many times talking about the amazing work that you do, and this is the most personal work that you have undertaken since you found Flyaway back in 1996. Why did you decide to pursue this issue, given that it's so personal for you?
I'm really happy to answer that question, but before I do, I just want to name one correction. Only half of the cast...
Oh, half?
Half of the cast has an incarcerated... or previously incarcerated family member.
Thank you.
Just want to be clear about that. It's hard to describe why I decided to do this. I think a lot of it has to do with coming into contact with Essie and understanding how much of a feminist and gender justice issue it is to... run into incarceration as a woman, not as a woman incarcerated, but as a woman with an incarcerated loved one, how much that's a feminist issue. And to have lived it and to understand it from inside my body, as well as intellectually and politically and socially, I think that was the catharsis, was really seeing my experience through a feminist lens and seeing a way to pull a whole community of women who are fairly invisible in the general culture into visibility through the arts. And I felt like, wow, I see a way to do this. And that it includes my story is difficult and emotional, but it's also been a lovely experience of my own work. For example, Pamela Z interviewed all of us, Jasmine and Anita and several other women for the project, and she also interviewed me. So I was suddenly on the other side of the tape recorder. And
what was that like for you?
It was kind of tweaky and freaky, but interesting. And my voice is in the piece. And I didn't think she was going to put my voice in the piece. I said, oh, don't use my voice. My voice is in the art. It's fine. But she did. She went behind my back and used my voice. And so it's it doesn't upset me as much as I thought it would. And it's interesting to be a subject in your own work. I've learned something.
And Pamela Z, you've worked with her on many of your pieces. Mm-hmm. She's an amazing sound engineer. And so much more.
Well, she's a composer.
Composer.
She's a composer, sound engineer, technician. She's one of the first, in some ways, only black women in new music. And she's just an amazing artist. And we've been working together since 1996. So we have a long habit of working with oral history. She works with text as sound better than anyone I know. And she's done an amazing job at integrating the interviews into art.
In all of your performances, you connect with a local group working on the issue. And how did you connect with the Essie Justice Group?
Well, I came across Essie because from a very personal place of feeling really desperate and going on the internet and saying, what's out there for me? And I found Essie. And because I was living in such a state of trauma when my husband was on the inside, I didn't actually connect with them with any depth until he came home. Because I just didn't have the bandwidth to do the one more thing. But I have now connected with them, and I went through the 9-week healing course, healing to advocacy course, and Jasmine was my cohort leader. And now I'm working to engage on the political side with Essie. And Essie's an amazing organization because they have this healing to advocacy model, and you need both sides. You can't do just one or the other and be an effective American, I think.
On the Essie Justice Group website, it says, quote, although millions of people experience the effects of mass incarceration, social support for women with incarcerated loved ones can be hard to find due to the intense stigma surrounding incarceration. The result is isolation, end quote. So why don't we talk a little bit about the work that Essie does. Jasmine, you credit the decision to see your father in prison. You saw him for the first time in 15 years last November. Mm-hmm. You credit that to the work that you did with Essie. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about what the group does.
So basically, I went through a cohort myself before co-facilitating a cohort in San Francisco, and the healing to advocacy model is based on advocating for self, advocating for your family, and advocating for your larger community. And, you know, I had never really learned how to advocate for self in that. Right. I learned a lot about, I feel like, as a black woman, to advocate for family and community, but it's like I jumped over myself in order to be able to function in those other two spaces. And I just felt like if I didn't get right with my own personal story and I didn't get right with all of the things that I had going on, whether or not it was work related, I just saw my father's incarceration translating into every facet of my life because it was something that I had built a wall around, but it was something that caused me to disassociate a lot in relationships. It was this... it felt like the ultimate rejection, the ultimate isolation, the ultimate just, it was a very out-of-body experience. That person is half of me, but I don't know very much about them. That person is supposed to be integral in my advancement in the world and in life. And yet, just gone, essentially, you know, but harboring this space that's so filled with pain for me for some reason that I can't really describe. So I knew that I needed to see my father in order to lead a cohort. And it happened all around the same time. I think I'd gone through facilitators training, but I knew I wouldn't have it to give to other women or the capacity to hold space for other women if I didn't just break down this thing that I thought I would just crumble around. Like, I thought I would just lose it in the visiting room because of so much, like, pain and fear, essentially. Yeah.
What was that experience like for you?
I used a lot of humor and sarcasm to get through it. But for something that I thought for so long would just devastate me, I realized that I'm grown, that I'm healed in a lot of ways from a lot of the things that kept me down, essentially. Excuse me. And it was to recognize that my father hasn't had the ability to develop beyond a certain age. It just felt like this person that was supposed to be this moniker or this leader in my life, it felt like I was trying to lift them and move them forward. So I recognize a lot of stagnation, not on his part, but just socially. There's no rehabilitation or advancement happening in those spaces. Even for a person who told me that they had a business plan and had taken courses, and my father was actually something like an intermediary at one point in one of the facilities that he was in between incarcerated people and some sort of board. It was kind of like a mayor or like a position of that status. And I just thought, if that person can operate in that way inside, what could they be outside? But at the same time, he just felt very, very young to me.
And how long has he been inside?
My father has been incarcerated. I'm 29. I think he came out for about a year, but he was incarcerated when I was born. Yeah, not conceived, of course, but when I was born.
Right. And and there's been hardly any rehabilitation throughout that entire time?
I think that there are some things that appear to be rehabilitative, but as far as like a person-to-person basis, maybe on paper there is, you know, I'm not trying to compromise anybody's release date or anything like that. But if you were to sit down and have a conversation, the level of conversation and the topics were just kind of like, so what?
Wow.
You can't advance beyond the people that you're around, right?
Right.
And if they're not being allowed to advance, who can you be and how can you be?
Are you planning to visit again?
I don't see myself visiting in the near future, but plan to try and be a bit more consistent with my level of contact. But I'm processing and I'm going to allow myself that ability to, and I'm going to move at my own pace. Yeah.
That is Jasmine Brown, an events coordinator and education facilitator for the Black Female Project and the SE Justice Group. Jasmine's father has been incarcerated for 28 years, most of her life, and she saw him for the first time in 15 years last November. She credits the decision to see him to the work that she has done with SE. Anita, your son was incarcerated in 2011, and you believe he was wrongfully charged. Can you tell us about the work that you've done with the SE Justice Group?
Yeah, I wanted to clarify that he was incarcerated in 2001, and my grandson, who is his namesake, was murdered in 2011. So he has been in prison since... he was arrested in 2001, held in county, tried and convicted in 2003, and he's been in prison ever since. He was sentenced to 66 years to life, and my situation was that I was trying to step in for my grandchildren, he has a daughter in Atlanta that he had just started getting, you know, into a relationship with. So I tried to keep that relationship going, tried to keep them connected, but she is not interested. You know, I can't say I blame her, you know, because she was just getting to know him and he got in trouble here in California. So she's, you know, like in her 30s, and that's my oldest granddaughter. His two sons here in the Bay Area, I tried to step in for them. And it was very difficult, extremely difficult, because his oldest son was very angry about why they took his father, you know, the father away. I was upset because I did not investigate his, you know, during his trial, I paid for an attorney, but I wasn't investigating him. I never investigated the attorney's background. He was just the person who accepted the money I had. I didn't have, you know, that much money. But he accepted what I had, but come to find out that he was working with the, you know, against my son because he was being disbarred. And the courts allowed him to come in and represent my son, knowing he was being disbarred. And I didn't know that because I didn't look up his background before, you know, until after my son's trial. So my son was convicted, and I talk about my son because I believe he was wrongfully convicted, you know. So he was accused of second degree murder or homicide, where someone was shot two blocks away from where he was. He was down the street arguing with this kid who had shot at him, and my son was 31, the kid was 21. He shot at him, at my son, and missed. And my son shot him in the toe, in the foot. So he turns around and runs back up the street towards where this guy is standing. And later, my son runs away down the street in the other direction. But this guy that was up here was hit by a bullet. And they said my son's bullet ricocheted two blocks and hit this man in the heart, which is easy to find out is a lie. All you have to do is look at the coroner's report. The guy was not even hit in the heart. He was hit here. And like in the scapula or wherever down, and it went down. So they arrested my son, and they gave the kid that had shot at him blanket immunity and to testify against my son. That meant that he became my son's victim. One of the charges against my son was attempted murder of this unarmed young man, even though there's GSR showing that that he had gunshot residue on his hand, that he had shot a gun. Okay, so that's that situation. You know, when I investigated, I found out that there were two witnesses saying that the guy that was shot by a drive-by shooter. And that's on paper. And then after my son was convicted and arrested, you know, like in 2013, I heard from the kid. You know, he was 21 years old at the time. And he sent me an email message and told me, well, you know, the police told me if I didn't testify against your son, that they were going to charge me with murder. That's why I testified against him. And I told him, I said, you don't know that someone else, because he didn't read the transcripts, he didn't know that someone else had said they witnessed a drive-by shooting. And when I told him that, he was like, I am so sorry, you know. But anyway, so that's my investigation. But all this time, like when I think about Joe and the dance, we're doing a dance, you know, from the time that my son was charged. You know, here comes the SWAT team in my apartment, even though my son didn't live with me. Here comes the SWAT team. It's a dance, and I'm dancing, and I'm thinking, where's my son? Where's my grandchildren? You know, what do I have to do? What are they charging him with? All of it is a dance, and you're thinking that you're not going to land on your feet. You're not going to survive this. But, you know, the first fear you have is that they're saying my son is armed and dangerous, that he needs to live. And what am I going to do? How am I going to keep him alive? You know, then you get to trial, you know, and you're going through the courts, and you're not only dealing with, you know, with the Oakland police, that's one part, then you're dealing with the DA, and you're dealing with the judge, and you're dealing with the jury. And it's just like it's like you're turning and turning and turning, and so dizzy and sick. That was the way I felt. Mm-hmm. I felt dizzy, sick. I felt alone. I was in a situation where I didn't have any people that I could go and talk to. My family did not want to hear it. He shouldn't have been out there that time of night in that environment. You know, we don't go into that environment, you know, where you have to carry a gun. So they didn't want to hear it. And I was really isolated. And it just happened that someone said to me, I mean, after my grandson was murdered, I became an activist, you know, against police murders, you know, even though I'm not saying for sure that I know that who murdered my grandson, I don't know. But, you know, I became an activist, and some of the people I met out in the street said, oh, this young lady is, you know, going to be at the Women's Foundation. She's having a lunch. Her name is Gina Clayton. And you might be interested in that because I was a part of Occupy Oakland, you know. So I was a part of that. And then we had Occupy for Prisoners, and I was a part of that. So they were telling me about this young lady who wanted to start, you know, a support group. And I really badly needed one. So that's when I met Gina. I went to the Women's Foundation. And then I became a part of her first focus group. But I was thinking, oh, my God, the odds are against this young woman doing this, you know. But she really had it together. And she formed Essie Justice Group. We formed it. We all, you know, like supported her. And we're behind her like 110% because... that's the only organization out there that has offered me the support that I need to heal, not just to be an advocate, which is part of it, to show me how to be an advocate and to make changes. Like we go up to Sacramento and we sit and we testify and we support legislation and we introduce legislation. So, and then we, you know, we go off to, you know, the Santa Cruz Mountains for a weekend and do a retreat. Sometimes it's a working one, sometimes it's a fun one. But we do, I've been a facilitator. I think I've done about everything there is in SC Justice Group, but this is the first organization that I've been a part of that has really looked at me as a human being, as a woman, and given me the strength and courage I need to continue on, you know. So,
well, thank you for sharing your story. We're going to take a quick break. That is Anita Wills. Anita and Jasmine Brown both work with the Essie Justice Group. It is an organization in Oakland with a mission to harness the collective power of women with incarcerated loved ones to end mass incarceration's harm to women and communities. 1 in 4 women and nearly 1 in 2 Black women has at one point had a family member in prison. We're also joined by Joe Kreider, founder and artistic director of Flyaway Productions. And The Weight Room is an upcoming new performance that explores the physical and emotional burdens incarceration places on women with loved ones who are behind bars. The Weight Room runs April 19th to the 27th in San Francisco, May 17th and 18th in Richmond, and then it's off to New York. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. All of the performances are free, and you do not need a reservation. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about a new aerial dance performance called The Weight Room. It explores the physical, psychic, and emotional burdens incarceration places on women with loved ones who are behind bars. And today's guests have very personal experiences with this issue. Joe Kreider is founder and artistic director of Flyaway Productions, an apparatus-based dance company that explores the range and power of female physicality and advances social issues in the public realm. I hope you can see The Weight Room. It kicks off this Friday, April 19th, and it runs through the 27th in San Francisco. It'll then travel to Richmond, California for two performances on May 17th and 18th, and then it's off to New York. And you can find more information about this free performance at yourcallradio.org. Jasmine Brown is an events coordinator and education facilitator for the Black Female Project and Essie Justice Group. And Anita Wills is the author of 7 books. She also works with the Essie Justice Group. Joe, I was really struck by what Anita said, that navigating all of these systems and trying to figure out what to do for your loved one is like a dance. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult and messy, especially if you don't have support. What are your thoughts on what she just said?
Well, Anita said when she was speaking a few moments ago, you're turning and turning and turning and turning. And we have designed a set that spins. We've designed a set where the floor drops out from under you. My experience, myself, and what I've culled from other women with incarcerated loved ones is that destabilization is at the center of our daily lives. And so we designed a set where destabilization is in the engineering and is fundamental to every moment of creation of the choreography. When I was testing the set when it was being built, I kept falling off it. And it felt like such an apt physical expression of what women with incarcerated loved ones live through. I say something when I talk about the piece, which is that being in proximity to the prison system, the prison system asks women to be in collusion with it. To be in collusion with the very system that is simultaneously bringing you down. Mm. And it's an extremely uncomfortable position because you want to support your loved ones. So you put money on the books and you pay for the phone calls to the best of your ability. And if they're in the state system, you can send packages. So you participate knowing that the system is dehumanizing, degrading your loved one and your own family. And it's just an incredibly uncomfortable thing. And Essie comes in and shines a light on your humanization. So as I've made this dance, I've tried to pick up where Essie has left off, or where Essie continues, actually, which is to really humanize the experience that women go through as we support our loved ones, as we advocate where there's wrongful conviction, as we advocate where there is ridiculous sentencing and situations imposed. So that's what I think about when I hear Anita say it's a dance.
And you talked about the phone call fees. There's so many costs involved. The commissary bills, attorney fees, bail bond debt, the visits, because in so many cases, prisons are far away from cities, in some cases a 5-hour drive, and it can be expensive to visit. And, you know, as you say, Joe, we talk about these issues a lot on this show, but until you've really been there, you don't really understand just how difficult it is to navigate.
Well, it's constant. My husband was incarcerated for 5 years, and there was constant crisis, crisis after crisis after crisis within the incarceration experience, starting at the pretrial situation through the sentencing. He was moved to Texas halfway through for no reason. So there's a constancy to the trauma that you have no choice but to navigate. You know, you don't give up. You can't give up. You have other family members. You have your loved ones. So there's a constancy to the trauma that is ongoing and daily. And as Anita said, you know, not everybody wants to hear about it. So your world can get extremely small. And I know that happened for me. My world got very, very small. And Essie has helped my world get just a little bit bigger again. Mm-hmm. And that's been a beautiful thing for me.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Jasmine, does that speak to your experience?
Yeah, the world being small. I just feel like with this level of healing, It's like this return to an original state or who you're supposed to be, like this opening up, the breaking of isolation. When you don't have other people next to you that can advocate with you and for you, your world is extremely small. Mm-hmm. When people tell you things like don't talk about it, you know, that's not everyone's business, that's your business. Well, if you're in business by yourself, you know, or if you don't have anybody to bounce ideas off of, you start to feel really alien. And I felt like growing up, I was just alien, dysfunctional. I also had this hyper awareness that people didn't really want to have, I just felt like people didn't want to deal with me growing up or have relationship with me. And I think that it was very burdensome or taxing on my extended family and immediate family, to the extent that just the presence of someone whose father is incarcerated, it's this thing that other people have to pick up and tote with them that someone else should be able to be responsible for, but they're not able to be responsible for. Mm. So I identify with that aspect that Joe was speaking about, like your world just being really condensed, and it's not open. Mm-hmm. It's not open in the same way that people who have all of their resources, the traditional family unit, right? It's not open in the same way.
We did a show about children whose parents are incarcerated or have been incarcerated, and the guests all said, you know, we're having this national conversation about mass incarceration in this country, mm-hmm. but we rarely talk about the children and what they go through. Mm-hmm. And since the war on drugs began in the 1980s, according to the National Institute of Justice, the rate of children with incarcerated moms has increased 100%. Mm-hmm. The rate of those with incarcerated fathers has increased more than 75%. I mean, these are huge numbers. And Jasmine, you said that if a loved one is incarcerated, the time that they're serving the child, you mm-hmm. are serving in another way.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. It's even from family visits, right? Like, you're on lockdown too. This is not, it's not like if you choose to be in relationship with this person, you go into that facility and you're on lockdown too. But there are aspects of your life that you can't even really carry a regular conversation about. You know, when someone asks, so how's your mom? How's your dad? Do you lie? Or do you tell the truth? Like, how far do you go into it without being heavy or burdensome to any given situation? And then that conversation branches out into larger issues that a lot of people don't want to talk about on a day-to-day basis. It's not a quote-unquote casual conversation, even though at this point with those kind of statistics, it's a casual thing at this point.
And I wonder what you all think of these statistics, because they're just thrown around, these numbers. And especially with two black women in the room, I'd love for you to tell us what you think of this. When you hear the media throwing these words around, one in four women and nearly one in two black women has at one point had a family member in prison. How does that affect you?
It's scary, because it's like, you know, like during slavery, when almost every black person that was a slave. So, you know, it wasn't even, I mean, it was the majority of black people were slaves. Now they're saying the majority or one in two of black people are in prison, you know somebody that was in prison or were in prison themselves. And it seemed to me like nothing much has changed since slavery. Mm-hmm. That, knowing the laws, the way the laws are set up, even when someone has done something, they are disproportionately sentenced. Black and brown are given sentences that are disproportionate to the crime that they committed. So someone who is arrested for robbery and has no record, a black person, They're looking at 10 to 15 years in prison for a robbery, and I'm not talking about anybody was even hurt, you know, for stealing, for the littlest crime, that the system uses that to put you to take that person out of the community and put them in a situation where they can be controlled.
Yeah.
You know, my son, when he was arrested, he was a journey level carpenter. He was taking care of his family, his children, and they did not care. He was paying taxes, but he did not get he did not get what a white male would have gotten, which is consideration for the fact that he's working, he's contributing to the community, he's a father. None of that, those mitigating circumstances were looked at during, you know, when he was on trial, when he was arrested. They did not care. And so it's an industry now. The prison system is an industry. They have private prisons. I talked to a lady last night whose son is serving a 223-year sentence.
Wow.
223 years. And they're saying, oh, there is no life. They're not, that's life. 20 years used to be life. So what is 223 years? Did he kill a bunch of people or what? You know, she said he robbed somebody. I don't know. But, you know, she's going to be hopefully a part of ESSE Justice Group. But that's what I'm saying, is that this disproportionate sentencing, that even if my son had, even if his bullet did accidentally kill that person, does he not have a right to stand your ground? Because if he was a white male, he would have been standing his ground. But he doesn't have that right as a black male to stand his ground, you know? And so it's not surprising to me that one and two are in prison, you know?
Jasmine?
I agree with what Miss Anita is saying, and I think a lot of times at ESSE, I also would encourage people to check out the national report that ESSE published in tandem with a lot of other social justice organizations called Because She's Powerful. The report is called Because She's Powerful, mm-hmm. but the website is becausesheespowerful.org. And it talks a lot about mass incarceration being a gender justice, a racial justice, and a economic justice situation. Mm-hmm. And so those statistics don't surprise me, because it's like legality and criminality are not linked directly to mm-hmm. morality. Mm-hmm. And that's what a lot of people have to come to the understanding around, is that when Miss Anita talks about it being akin to slavery, you know, if you've watched the film 13th, they talk about black bodies inherently becoming criminal at a certain point in U.S. history.
Right.
And so we're not talking about what someone did that was right or wrong or any of those things. It's just talking about a prison industrial complex where, at this point, this is generating a lot of revenue rather than a lot of rehabilitation and a lot of socialization for people who are incarcerated. So, yeah, those mm-hmm. statistics are true to form.
And to that point, more than half of the U.S. prison population has never been convicted of a crime, but they're being held on, quote, pretrial detention.
Yes.
Because they cannot post bail. And when they're able to post bail, the burden of paying the bail and the court fees often falls on family members. 83% mm-hmm. are women. And in an interview with Jezebel Jasmine, you mm-hmm. said that you used to see commercials for bail bond companies mm-hmm. talking about wanting to get family members home.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so you think that they're allies, right? And then you realize they're a part of this entire concept right. that keeps your loved ones forever indebted to cycles of abuse, trauma, and poverty, because people are putting up homes, they're putting up collateral. You know, Arissa Hall was a special guest at the ESSE retreat, was a week ago now.
Yes.
And she's a part of the national bailouts. And I believe, I hope I'm not misquoting that, mm-hmm. but we do Black Mama's Day bailouts right. in Alameda County. ESSE Justice Group is over that. And we bailed out one of our ESSE sisters, Jamisha.
Mm-hmm.
And just what that system, like the effect that that system had on her ability to work,
mm-hmm.
her ability to provide for her son, it's
Yeah.
It's really mind-blowing, honestly, because, like you said, people are sitting in there and they haven't been convicted of anything. They're just sitting there waiting for someone to allow them out, and that's the first thing that you want, and that industry just feeds into that. You haven't been convicted of anything. Right. Why are you being held? And why are you being held for ransom? Mm. It makes absolutely no sense, and there are some places where the money is not just... That's what Arissa was telling us. The money isn't good enough in certain right. states. You have to also put up some other form of collateral. Mm-hmm. So what does that say?
Right.
It's the possession. It's the stealing of bodies. It's the stealing of property. It's the stealing of place right. in the United States. Yeah. And so who's truly criminal at this point?
And we also, SE Justice, we were co-sponsors of AB 42 and SB 10, which passed, which was the ending of the money bail system. However, SB 10, what it did was it stripped, even though the money bail system itself is out of the picture, it still gave too much power to these judges who are over sentencing and who are holding. What they're doing now is they're holding people without bail. Instead of saying they're still not ORing people who are charged and not haven't even gone to trial. So they're still pulling people out of the community, and these people are being held without bail. So we kind of pulled back from supporting SB 10 because it did not do what we initially wanted it to do. Mm-hmm. We want to take it out of the hands of the racist system, and the system is handing it all, you know, is hand in hand together. The judges work with the DA, work with the, you know, work with prosecutors, you know, to support the prison industrial complex. Mm-hmm. It's all one big web, like a spider web. So we have to pull it apart piece by piece.
Oh, can I?
Jasmine.
It was just really interesting seeing the film 13th mm-hmm. because of all of the companies that are intertwined with the lobbying that goes into these systems, right, and the labor that's virtually free for a lot of corporations and companies in the United States. And I won't say who but I have a family member that has been working for a corporation that is in my direct lineage, right? And we never knew until that film that company that had been sustaining food on my table is inherently a part of the prison industrial complex. So how is it that you have one person out of the game and then you have another person who's trying to do the right thing, but their labor literally factors into keeping that person incarcerated?
Mm-hmm. And 13th, you can see on Netflix and hopefully other platforms, but yes. This is a really important movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everybody should see that.
Thank
movie.
You for bringing that up. Mm-hmm. Joe, what would you do? You have something to add just about the prison industrial complex?
Well, I have a small story.
Okay.
When I dropped my husband off, he self-surrendered at a facility in Southern California, and they made him give me his shoes, his tennis shoes, so he couldn't keep his own tennis shoes. And then he was given these very, very, very heavy boots, which are very uncomfortable. So once I put money on his books, he went and bought the exact same tennis shoes that he had handed over to me. Hmm. And it's just a little microcosmic story of how money is made off families.
Hmm. And Joe, do you have anything else to add about the racial aspect of this? I mean, one in two black women has at one point had a family member in prison. One in four women in the wider population has had a family member in prison.
Mm-hmm.
Did your husband tell you anything about what he saw in terms of race?
Well, what he said is that everything that he went through in struggle in the prison system, people of color went through 10 times worse. Mm-hmm. And the racism within the system, the social gaming inside the prison system is very racialized. You sit at tables with your own. As a white man in prison, he was confronted with the white nationalists and made his choice to not identify with them. So it's very racialized on the inside. I'd say on the outside, which is where this the piece that I've made is about proximity to prison rather than being inside, because that's not something that I know about. I feel like one of my responsibilities, because much of my community is white, is to bring a racial justice lens to the people that I know, because they've watched me go through some difficult things and they have great empathy. So what I can do is open the world a bit to say, well, you know, and this is the way that it's racialized for people who don't have our skin color.
We have a related caller. We don't have too much time, KDF, but we wanted to bring you in to the conversation. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for this show, Rose, and thank you for including me. There is an attorney with the American Friends Service Committee whose last name is Abu Salem, and his phrase is legal and structural violence. And the position that the white male overclass has been pushing on us has been to pimp us in one way or another. And when you're in jail, you are being pimped because they're making money off of you. And the other thing that I wanted to mention was, don't you think that if Sandra Bland had been a white woman and the majority of the people in that police department had been black, that we would have heard a lot more about how she died?
Well, thank you. A lot of people wonder if she would have even been arrested. It was, I don't remember the details, something about the turn signal, right? Yeah, thank you, KDF, for calling in. We have just about 5 minutes left, and or 4 minutes left, and I want to ask you both, and then we're going to talk just about what people can expect when they see The Weight Room. Jasmine and Anita, what was it like working with Flyaway Productions on this performance? Jasmine?
It's very hard to go on record with something, right, where you say something and it's recorded for who knows how long in the universe and in the atmosphere. But being in the same space with Joe for 9 weeks, it allowed me to open up to her in a way that I haven't been able to open up to a lot of people in my lifetime. And so to be able to trust her with the integrity of my story, that was a huge thing. And I just remember, like, the theme for me, it just felt like there was a lot of love in the room, so I could occupy that space. I didn't have to occupy a space that was filled with, like, angst, trauma, hatred. Like, all of it is there. Like, I understand that there's some of that that I bring into a room, and I try not to. But at the same time, I felt so at peace with my story. Yeah, so it was beautiful, and I'm really excited to also be a part of the production team throughout the week, this coming week. So, yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
What about you, Anita?
It was, it was really like cathartic, you know. It was like when I was in that little tiny room, it was like I was stuck in there with my story as it was coming out of my mouth. But my another Essie sister, Caddy, was there. So her and I walked down the street, the beautiful street together, breathed the fresh air, went and had dinner. And it was just a release to be able to tell, you know, to tell the story and see her beautiful smile when you walked out of the booth and everything. You know, I can't wait to see the results. I can't wait to see the results.
Joe, what can people expect?
Well, I'll give away one thing. We opened the finale, the last section, with something Anita says. She says, I love my child. I just have to say that out loud. And that's the opening of the finale, which I call This is a Love Story. The piece is unlike anything I've ever made. Most of my dances happen on walls. And for this project, we've built a self-sustaining set where you can fly without being attached to anything structural. It's a piece of engineering brilliance by Sean Riley. Pamela Z has done an incredible job taking the heart and essence and good and value of the women who've told us their stories and turning it, transforming it into something that the imagination can sync up with. We're on this lot, this big empty lot right off Market Street where we're facing the federal building on one side, UN Plaza on the other. If I get on my tippy toes, I can see the courthouse where my husband was convicted from the lot. So it's a very powerful sight. I feel like we've done a lot of things right. Now we just need our audience.
Wow. And just quickly, Joe, what response have you received from organizations that are working to end mass incarceration?
Well, we've done a lot of outreach, and hopefully they're coming to the show. And I don't have an answer to that. If you ask me that after the show, I'll have a much better answer.
Well, and the thing I think that's great is art. I mean, what your piece is when they're on the street, I love watching as people who had no idea that this was happening stop and watch and are so mm-hmm. affected by it. Mm-hmm. And this can bring a whole new element to this mm-hmm. conversation around mass incarceration.
Yeah, this project is slightly different because there's a big wall on Market Street at 1125 Market Street where the show is. And we built a Pacific Eagle who donated the land to us to host the site. They built a door into the wall, but we don't have quite the same public exposure in process just because of the nature of the architecture of the site. Mm-hmm. But we hope that people will come because it's free. We hope that a lot of prison-impacted families will come because it's free. We're doing two workshops with the public, two master classes. They're on the website. We have some folks from Project What coming to that workshop. Those are folks those are teens whose parents are or were incarcerated. So check out the master classes if you want to come do some dancing and come to the show.
Well, the Wait Room runs April 19th through the 27th at 1125 Market Street in San Francisco, and then it goes to Richmond for two performances, May 17th and 18th. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Joe Kreider is the founder and artistic director of Flyaway Productions. Jasmine Brown and Anita Wills do work with the SE Justice Group. It's an organization in Oakland with a mission to harness the collective power of women with incarcerated loved ones. Joe, Jasmine, and Anita, thank you all
thank
for
you.
Coming in.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you so much. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.